Hi, I'm Jamie Poisson.
Oh my god, look at that. Holy shit, that's hot.
You may have seen this harrowing video from a few days ago, taken on a drive out of Lytton, BC. For 3 days in a row, the town had recorded the hottest temperature ever in Canada. Then it caught fire.
The whole village is going.
In the video, flames are erupting along the highway, swallowing up buildings in this tiny village of only about 250 people. The plumes of smoke are so heavy that you can hardly see the road ahead. Here's resident Gordon Murray, who took that video.
Where our house was, there weren't flames everywhere. There was smoke everywhere. And so we only realized how bad it was when we got down to that road and started driving up it and saw those houses just like literally, I mean, we could actually hear the timbers exploding as we were driving along, and the poles, I think the poles were exploding. It was just, it was like being in a movie. That says, it's hard to express how shocking it was.
As Gordon said there, this all exploded so quickly. People had to leave without any time to grab their things. Edith Loring Kahanga was on a Zoom meeting when she heard the sound of sirens screech past her house. She had a single suitcase packed because of a planned trip.
So I had that packed sitting by the door, and I just threw my laptop in my briefcase, grabbed the laptop and my suitcase, ran out the door. And then I realized I didn't have my purse, so I ran back in to get my purse. And when I came out and opened up the door and went to step on the stairs, that's when the explosion happened. It was a huge explosion. And then it was like a horror movie. It was all of a sudden everything went dark and gloomy, and there was debris flying all over the place and everything. So it was really traumatic. Like, it was just unbelievable. And people were running all over the place and saying, get out, get out, get out.
Most of the town has been completely destroyed, and two people have been confirmed dead. This is in addition to the hundreds of deaths across the province believed to be linked to the extreme heat. And now BC is battling nearly 200 fires. More than 1,000 people have already left their homes, and about a dozen fires are being monitored really closely because they could result in evacuation orders any minute. Today, two of my colleagues are here. They've been covering the tragedy in Lytton and the fires more widely, and we're going to discuss what it's like for people living with this very real and present danger. I'm here with CBC Vancouver video journalist Susie De Silva and CBC Kelowna reporter Brady Strachan. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Thank you so much for making the time. I know you're both very, very busy right now, so we appreciate it. And Brady, I'll start with you. We're reaching you before noon in Kelowna on Monday in interior BC. And there are a few notable fires near Kamloops, which is a couple hours away from you. And what is the latest?
Well, Jamie, yeah, there are quite a few fires. They estimate around 200 active fires in the province. And everyone's heard of the big heat wave we had last week. And following those record-breaking temperatures, we had a lot of lightning strikes all over the Cariboo and the Thompson region. And those sparked dozens of fires. Many of them have grown just enormous in size. Probably the biggest one is the Sparks Lake Fire that's north of Kamloops. It's 360 square kilometers in size now.
Oh,
and that's
wow.
After less than a week of growth, 400 homes are on an evacuation order there. About 1,000 people are under evacuation alert. And that's only one of the major fires. There's other fires near 100 Mile House that have several hundred people on evacuation order. There's fires near Lillooet, near Prince George, and also, of course, the horrific fire that burned through Lytton last week.
I wonder if you could put this in context for me a little bit. Like, my understanding is fire season doesn't typically start this early, right?
Usually we get what's called the June rains here. That we get this after spring, we get sort of a bit of a rainy season here, if you can call it that, even in the interior, but enough to sort of dampen down the forest. They talk about fire fuels, so that's trees that had fallen down in years past, and they get a good soaking. And so that sort of delays the fires from really taking off for some time until a little bit later in the summer. But we didn't get that at all this year. We missed out on any rain almost in the interior. So when this heat wave came and these lightning strikes came, everything was tinder dry and just ripe to burn. And so we're getting these explosive fires very kind of early in the fire season. We would normally get fires that would grow sort of in later in July or in August when it is really dry. But we are seeing those dry conditions a lot earlier.
And Susie, Brady mentioned residents that are on alert here, evacuation alerts. And I wonder if you could tell me, what does it mean for residents when they have to be on evacuation alert? Like, what is that like?
Unease, I think, is probably the way to describe it. I mean, never knowing, constantly watching, almost opening your window and sniffing, right, to see if there's smoke in the air. What is coming? I spoke to a woman, she's part of the Boston Bar Fire Department there, about having to keep, you know, she's got kids and a cat, and to keep bags packed, ready to go, because you never know. And she was actually driving up, coming to a lookout, and just checking for spot fires, looking for potentially any little smoke anywhere that could potentially be something. So it is this sense of an ease. It's this constant fear. And they see, especially these communities nearby that saw what happened to Lytton so quickly, they all know that could have been them and that could still be them.
And this sounds so stressful. You got to think it would be so hard to even like get a good night's sleep. I want to talk about Lytton now. So we're only beginning to understand the scope of the tragedy there. And Brady, what do we know at this point about how it happened?
Well, we know that the fire destroyed about 90% of the homes in the town itself, and 1,000 people from that area, from the town and the north, many First Nations and other rural communities north of town have left. And I'm sure many people have seen the devastating photos that just show the town razed and much of the main infrastructure in the town, the police station, the ambulance station, all the buildings on the town's main street are just in ashes and burnt down to their foundations. And in the days after this, we spoke to people at evacuation centers who fled, and they described for us just the frantic struggle of suddenly realizing there was a fire burning in their town, burning their neighborhood down, and then just the struggle to get out. I spoke to one man named Eli McKeeve, and I met him at a hotel he was staying at in Merritt. He had to borrow a shirt from a friend of his in Merritt because he literally left with his shorts, his shoes, his dog, and his car. I think he had his wallet as well, so he does have his ID. And he just described this harrowing story of the fire encroaching on his neighborhood.
Well, it was right there. It was already on our doorstep. My neighbors, he's got a woodshed there, and he just stocked it for wood for the winter. It caught on fire, and then his siding on his house was melting. He had a great big propane tank, and I could hear that thing starting to hiss, so I guess it blew. And then I got a big propane tank, and I'm only about 12 feet away from his place. I just grabbed my dogs, and I just barely made it out. I had to stop twice because of the smoke. I couldn't see where I was going. Oh, it was blowing hard. It was just like a blowtorch. Finally, I got a break in the smoke, and I got out. It was terrible.
And it, almost in a bit of a state of shock, as people describe this to you. This is a very traumatic event, and now people are wondering if they'll have anything to go back to. Will the town rebuild? Will the people in the neighborhoods that they knew be changed forever? So it's just so devastating to hear the stories of the people who have in many cases lost everything.
Susie, what about you? I know you've also spoken to people in Lytton, and did you meet anyone whose story stuck with you?
Yeah, lots of people's story. I mean, obviously, it's like a PTSD for a lot of them, saying that even days later, they're still trying to process exactly what happened. No one, it seems at this point, lost more than Jeff Chapman, who was a gentleman that we spoke to. He was actually staying at a hotel in Abbotsford. He had gone down that way. And he tells a story that is so tragic and terrible and unbelievable. It's almost hard to believe that it happened. And he was there with his parents.
We were just having a good afternoon. You know, we're always happy-go-lucky people. And, you know, we're going to have a barbecue that afternoon. My parents took off. They were going to go get a few steaks. And they came back. And right around that time, same time, I noticed there's smoke. And
then a few minutes later, sparks start coming. He says they decided to try to protect what they had, to protect their home, what they had built.
Late. It was too late. And I was just trying to save what me and my dad and family worked for our whole life.
They decided to stay and sort of put out a fire. We talked about putting out a fire here.
Well, it just went so fast. I finally got one little spot fire out, and then this one started, and now our shed's on fire. The shed went up. Like, the time I knew that there was, I seen smoke and knew there was trouble, I don't even think it was 10 minutes, you know, but that felt like 10 hours.
And part of the issue was that it wasn't just a wall of fire that was coming towards them. There were sparks that were flying everywhere. So a house that was further up the hill away from the fire was more engulfed than their home became, because things were flying everywhere.
You know, and at first I thought it was just us, like we're the only ones burning up. But then, you know, the next thing I realized, no, the whole town's going off.
And they just were trying to put it out, and then they realized it was too late, that they just were not going to be able to get out. His parents were in their 60s, but he said his father had mobility issues, and there was just no way they were going to be able to outrun. They were surrounded, and so they made the decision that they would go down in a trench that they had dug, and he put some tin over top of them.
Slid it over, and I almost went in with them. I hesitated, and I went, I was not in the room, and I pulled the piece of sheet over, and I ran, and as soon as I started running away, the power line that comes through between my neighbor's house, I don't know what happened. At first I thought the house burnt to the point where the wires could pull out of the house, but no, there was some kind of a jolt or something happened, pulled the line, the wire right out of the house. It came right down top.
He ran. He thought the best place would be near the railroad tracks where there was gravel and sort of should be, you know, cleared out area that he could go try to stay out of that fire, and he lay there for about 45 minutes, he says.
Because there's just too much smoke, and I was so drained that I couldn't. I could take two steps, and I just dropped to the ground.
Fucking hot. Fuck. Oh, my God. This, I don't wish this upon anybody.
And you see video of him screaming and crying for his parents. It is heartbreaking.
Oh,
it is gut-wrenching to see it.
Fuck, please. Please. Please, God. Whatever, you know, please help us. Please help my mom and dad and my brother and my animals. Please. I don't care. Take me, but just don't care anybody else. I deserve it, not them.
And once he said it sort of simmered down a little bit. I mean, it was still chaos and hot. He said the heat that he could feel. His hair was singed, just the heat. But he's like, I have to go check on them.
I went back up to the house, and I was yelling and screaming for my mom. My dad yelled and screamed, Mom, Dad, and I came up and I seen what was left of my mom burning. That's the last image I have of my mom, is watching her burn.
And he realized there was nothing he could do to save them. He needed to get out. If he waited any more minutes, he was not going to make it himself. He was able to get his truck.
And I got to the top where I was safe, and I knew it was still on fire, and I got out, and I'm kicking my melting taillights off my truck before the rest of it lit up.
But he was able to drive it out. And when I first spoke to him, I wanted to know, is he really ready to be speaking? How can he be ready to speak and try to understand that, even before sort of we decided to interview him, to know that he was mm-hmm. really ready? And for him, he said it helped him to talk about it, to try to process it. But for him, he really wanted to speak out, because at that point, his parents were still out there. They were saying that it was unsafe for the RCMP and the coroner to get into that community.
Yeah. They're still laying out there. They're still laying out there. And that's the hardest part, knowing that. Again, I'm not blaming anybody, but why? Why?
So he really wanted to speak about his parents, who they were, his mother, his father.
He was such a hard worker. You know, he would take the shirt off his back for anybody. The same way, she was the most caring, giving person I know. you know, she would make sure anybody was taken care of before herself, you know, like everybody would be sitting at the table and she'd still be making something and be like, sit down at the table. Oh, no, don't worry about me. I got it all. You know, she was just, mom, she's mom, you know, everything that he would want from a mom.
So he wanted people to recognize the real, obviously the tragedy of people losing their homes is awful, but he wanted people to understand the human tragedy that this has caused. And he wants accountability. He wants to know, he says, you know, on that day, he knows that there's very little anyone could have done. I mean, it moved in so quickly, it was so dry, the conditions, but he does want to know, was there anything that could have been done ahead of time to prevent this? And he wants to know how it started. Does someone need to be held accountable? And he said, you know, this isn't about money or getting, you know, liability in that sense. He wants answers.
You know, like, no money can replace my parents. It's not about that, but somebody has to be liable for this, you know?
And Brady, if I could bring you in here, you know, on this idea, you know, that Jeff Chapman is searching for answers here about prevention, about accountability. Is there a sense that the province was prepared for what happened here?
There's really a lot of criticism in how this emergency was handled by the people that were caught up in it. I heard from evacuees who said that they were told by police officers to go to a certain town, and when they got to that town, you have to go, you know, another 2 hours south to this other community where you can finally register. But even more than that is criticism by a number of First Nations that live north of Lillooet, which of course were impacted by the fire, saying that they reached out to the province for help on coordinating the emergency, on getting muster stations set up, on getting a system in place to take evacuee information, but heard no response for hours. And meanwhile, one of the First Nations chiefs said, as a rancher, he has other completely different provincial officials calling him, checking in on his cattle and seeing if his cattle are okay. And so he's outraged that he's trying to save people's lives, human lives, and yet the first response he gets is about cattle. So there's a lot of criticism there. The province has responded to that and said that they did not live up to expectations and that there were gaps in protocols. But many people are wondering if the province and the can handle these type of fires going forward for the rest of the summer and years beyond, because we're reaching heat levels that are unprecedented. And this is a bit of a side story, but I think it is related. When talking about the heat which came before the fires, there were more than 700 people that died over a three-day period in the province that could have been related to heat-related stress. And the BC Coroner Service says they usually have about a third of that sudden deaths, but there were more than 700 in that period of the immense heat. And so many people are asking, we knew this heat was coming. We saw the forecasts a week in advance. How come systems were not put in place to better handle this and save lives?
Mm-hmm. And Susie, what are you hearing now about what needs to be done here to address this?
Yeah, and going back to that, I mean, part of that is also this communication, the lack of communication and better information many of these communities ask for. I mean, you also have challenges in some of these areas where there's no cell service. And so they're desperately trying to figure out where they can get information from. You have community members who are saying they have people who are still missing. And then, you know, one small First Nation near Lytton said, you know, we've opened up our information center and or our center here for people to come by. They can get water. They can stay here if they need. need. And what they would do is they'd take down names of people who came through, and then they'd have to drive down the highway to a spot where they could get cell service. And then they would do what they could there, whether it's through Facebook, social media, whatever, to say, hey, this person is safe, to try to reunite people. So there are so many challenges that are still playing out that they are wondering, you know, what can we do in the future? We're seeing, like in Lytton, there is not time. You need plans in place that can be enacted that second. And so they are all wondering that. And yes, we talk about, you know, the timing and the where we are July 5th right now, that we're in this situation already. How is this just going to be the way it is from now on? And how are we going to respond to that? And we need to quickly, because we don't have the luxury of 10 years to do some more studies and plans. What can we do to be ready for this year and in the immediate years following? Because this people fear this could be what we will be seeing more of going forward.
Right. And I mean, just to end on that note, and going back to Lytton resident Gordon Murray, who we heard from at the beginning of this episode, he said something that really stuck with me. You know, he essentially said that the town was a microcosm for who is most vulnerable to climate change.
Because we are, it's a small rural indigenous low-income community, and we're at the point, the spear point of climate change, but it's coming for everybody. We're the canary in the coal mine. We had the heat and the chaos, but we weren't prepared, and I don't believe that society is prepared in the same kind of way.
Jamie, I am hearing that sentiment from other people that I've spoken to in the past week, and I've been covering fires in this region for the last decade, and it does seem very different this year. It seems the heat, the extreme heat, the dryness, and the aggressive fire behavior is something that has taken everybody unaware, it seems. It is. Are we the canary in the coal mine? He sets it up perfectly asking that question. And I think this is something that we will have to grapple with over the next weeks and months and years after fire season, whenever that is, because this is different. This is unprecedented what we've experienced here over the last, say, 5 or 6 days. And I think anyone who's in this area, in the southern interior, and is seeing the smoke fill the skies again, or has a loved one that is displaced or is displaced themselves, are feeling that sentiment that we are in new territory here.
Okay, well, please be safe out there to you both. Brady, Susie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
You're welcome, Jamie.
On Monday, over 100 out-of-province crews are expected to arrive in BC to help with firefighting efforts. According to the BC Wildfire Service, those resources will be dispersed across interior BC. Bill Blair, the Federal Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness, also said that the Canadian military will provide air support for areas affected by the wildfires until July 19th. That's it for today. I'm Jamie Poisson. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.